Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Sometimes a single event can change our whole sense of food. It could be that guy that you met, the one from Thailand who cooks and romances brilliantly, and he got you, the spice hater, to love chilies. Or failing that final, and then the dawn breaks. Living on Red Bull and Cheetos may not be such a good idea after all. Or life does one of its nasty little U-turns, and you go through what singer Sheryl Crow did. Well, today she tells how she, the woman who didn't give two hoots about what she ate, came to do a cookbook. This and a lot more coming up this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is brought to you by Bing. Only Bing now integrates information from your friends on Facebook and experts on Twitter so that you can tap into their knowledge and opinions. Now, search goes social with Bing.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Songwriter Sheryl Crow never paid much attention to what she ate. And that was understandable. I mean, when you're on tour all the time, you're writing, you're singing, you're gathering up 9 Grammys. Besides, she was strong and healthy and pretty invincible. Well, in 2006, the word vulnerable entered Sheryl's world. There was a diagnosis of breast cancer, and with it came a nutritionist and a realization. What Sheryl ate mattered. A lot. How she eats now and her story are in her cookbook, If It Makes You Healthy. Sheryl Crow, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I've got to ask you, is a book tour easier than a performing tour?
It's a lot different. Music is something that I love, and I also, it's therapeutic for me, and I get an immediate exchange. And a book signing can be a little bit like that.
Right, right.
But for the most part, it's maybe not quite as spontaneous, but nonetheless fun.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a really small town called Kennett in the Boot Hill of Missouri. So really, basically, I grew up right on the Tennessee and Arkansas border in southern Missouri. So we grew up with lots of barbecue right across the border in Arkansas, and a lot of southern cooked food, a lot of fried food. And then as the years went on, my mom was and is such a great cook and really loves cooking and loves reading cookbooks. She got into cooking healthy, that was kind of the advent of my curiosity with food.
Did you then start cooking?
My sisters and I were basically designated table setters, but because she always loved it so much, we would stand around, and that's when we got most of our conversation in, was when she was cooking and standing around the kitchen and stuff. But we really didn't cook that much. And, you know, it's interesting. My diagnosis 5 years ago was a real turning point, because up until that point, food for me had just been about sustenance. And it was slightly inconvenient, really, to be so on the go all the time and have to stop and figure out what I was going to eat. And so my cancer diagnosis was really what changed the way I looked at food.
How did it change it?
Well, I think most people will attest to, once they get their diagnosis, to becoming a student of cancer or a student of whatever it is they've been diagnosed with.
Right.
And you want to find out as much as you can, and you want to be proactive in your maintaining your wellness. And in my particular instance, my cancer was discovered at a very early stage, but I wanted to make sure that everything that I could possibly be doing, I was doing with regard to staying well. And so much of what we put into our bodies has an immediate response, really. And anyone will tell you in the world of nutrition that no matter how many supplements, no matter how many vitamins, minerals, whatever it is that you're taking, the best source of that will always come from food.
So how did you change the way you ate then? Since you were on, I can understand you're a performer, you're on the road, you know, food isn't a primary thought.
Yeah, I mean, I was really a person who ate out of room service menus, and you really never know when you're eating in restaurants and out of room service menus what, you know, if the food is organic, if it's even fresh. I was a person that would eat a tuna salad sandwich every day because I liked tuna and it was easy. So I would go to the gig and I would eat the tuna that was there. I really didn't put a lot of thought into it. And when I was diagnosed, I hired a nutritionist and I started learning about food in general and about wellness. And it became sort of a source of interest for me.
Right.
And I hooked up with Chuck White.
He's a chef, right?
He's a chef. He was already incorporating local foods and was already eating organic, already had a really strong sense of what was in different kinds of foods that was immune boosting and wellness enhancing. You know, I think people think when you're talking about healthy that you're going to eat nuts and tablecloths and grain and hemp. And, you know, it's just, it's not the case. And one of the reasons I wanted to do the cookbook with Chuck was that he had served a chocolate mousse. And I'm not a big sweet eater, but a chocolate mousse at dinner one night. And it was basically cocoa and avocado sweetened with agave with a little bit of coconut water on the top of it. And it was just so tasty. And little things like that that are just great. Especially as a mom, to be able to fix your kid or use as bribery. Meanwhile, you're feeding him something really good for him, and he thinks he's getting a treat.
You have two boys. So are they good eaters?
I have two boys. Let's just say yes, I do have two boys. And one of them is just turning a year, and he would eat anything I put in front of him. Now, I'm sure that will change because that's what tends to happen. My four-year-old was that way when he was one. And now he's become much pickier. And he doesn't, you know, the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree. He's a little salt fiend like I am. So we just try to keep it creative. And the rule is you have to at least try it. Whatever's in front of you, you have to at least try it.
Right. So you're heading out on tour and you are eating all this healthy food. Is this the way your whole group eats now when they're on tour?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Touring in the last few years has not been that lucrative because everyone's touring. Nobody's buying records anymore, so everyone tours. And the economy is what it is. So we all know as artists that the best way to be able to afford being an artist is to go out and play, which is great with me because I love it. But I always say, no matter whether we lose money or break even, I will always take Chef Chuck with me, or if he can't do it, someone of a like mind, because I feel like food is a morale booster as well as an immune booster when already our immune systems are being taxed by the fact that we're living on buses, we're breathing bus air, we're living in hotels, the hours are not typical. You want everyone to feel like they're being taken care of, and for me, it is the one area that I just don't script on anymore, because I feel like people give their time and their lives to come out on the road and support me, so the best way I can support them is to feed them in a healthy way. So our dinner time on the road is really about spending time with each other and eating something healthy and then going out and playing music.
Sounds pretty great.
It's fantastic.
Cheryl, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Cheryl Crow's book, written with Chef Chuck White, is If It Makes You Healthy. Now, you can find a copy of one of her favorites, Chocolate Avocado Mousse Martinis with Fresh Raspberries, on the website, splendidtable.org. Every day is a winding road. I get When Jane and Michael Stern started tracking good local food, well, they didn't know that it was going to come with a generous side of pop culture. Well, they write about both on their road food site, and they report on it here. Jane, Michael, I understand you guys have a new tome coming out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do, and it really is a tome because it's a giant encyclopedic book. It's called The Lexicon of Real American Food, and it explains the names and where it comes from of all the foods that have become woven into the tapestry of this country's way of eating.
So what are some examples?
I'll tell you, one of my favorites is Fluffernutter. Now, if you're not from New England or haven't spent a lot of time here, you may never have even heard of it. A lot of these are very regional. Fluffernutter is so important in the state of Massachusetts that, in fact, the state legislature once spent an entire week debating the question, should Fluffernutter become the official state sandwich?
And that's where our taxes are going. That's nice to know.
And was this a bipartisan effort?
Well, they debated it. And in fact, it was voted down because what Fluffernutter is a combination of marshmallow fluff and peanut butter generally spread on white bread. And needless to say, many state legislators declared, no, we don't want to do this for nutrition's sake. However, the fact is that marshmallow fluff was invented in Massachusetts about a century ago. The interesting thing about it is there are two claims for who invented it. One says it was Archibald Query in Somerville, Massachusetts. The other says it was Amory and Emma Curtis in Melrose, Massachusetts. In either case, it was done around the time of World War I when people were looking for alternative sources of protein. Marshmallow fluff somehow was invented to fill that need. Don't ask me why.
It's like ketchup is the great vegetable.
Right.
That's fabulous. I love it.
No, I think the idea was it would improve other proteins. And in fact, Mrs. Curtis, one of the so-called inventors, published a recipe for something she called the Liberty Sandwich, which was marshmallow cream, marshmallow fluff,
right,
and peanut butter on bread made with oats or barley.
Oh, well, now that's healthy.
Now, there you go. That's good for you.
All right. But now we've got to get back to serious gastronomy. So if we go into a fancy restaurant, I mean, is there a place where I can find the ultimate Fluffernutter sandwich?
Yes, for your amuse-bouche, you will get a little Fluffernutter in a
Todd
crouton.
English is not serving this, that is me. I'm pretty darn sure. But even though the state legislature couldn't decide on it being the official state food, they did declare that October 8th should be National Fluffernutter Day.
Kudos to the legislator, and I can't remember his name, who was quoted in the paper saying, I'm going to fight to the death for fluff. My kind of politician.
Thank you, guys.
All right, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds behind roadfood.com. Now, you can find their weekly road food picks at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our latest find, our summertime grilling guide. It's a collection of recipes and tips designed to get you cooking in the great outdoors. Check it out. You know where. splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with the man with no taste and the perfect picnic sandwich. But you're going to need a 7-year-old. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is brought to you by Bing. Only Bing now integrates opinions from your Facebook friends and experts on Twitter to help you make better decisions. For instance, if you're planning summer travel, enter your destination at Bing, and along with Price Predictor to help you get the lowest rates, you'll see hotels, restaurants, or excursions liked by your Facebook friends, and opinions from experts and enthusiasts from Twitter. Plus, easily post questions and comments to your Facebook friends in Bing. All so you can spend less time searching and more time doing. Now, search goes social with Bing. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
We'll be right back.
grass is soft, the sun is out. It's time to hike. So you tramp back into the woods, you find a stretch of sunny meadow, spread out a blanket, unload the backpacks, and practice the great art of the picnic. With a few caveats. There are foods that picnic brilliantly, and there are foods that should never leave the house. Melissa Clark is here with the Picnic Crib Sheet. She writes the Good Appetite column for the New York Times. Melissa, good to have you back with us.
Great to be here.
So what do you like to take on picnics?
Lynn, one of my favorite picnic foods ever is something called a pan bagnat. It's a sandwich that they eat in the south of France, and it is two slices of really thick country bread, or actually a whole loaf of country bread that's cut in half and filled with tuna and olives and onions, capers and anchovies and all of my favorite things. But the best part is how you make a pan bagnat. And I have to give you guys a little bit of background because it's sort of a funny story. When I was a little kid, my parents would take my sister and I on vacation, and we would go to the south of France. Every year we would exchange our house in Brooklyn with some, you know, strange house in the Riviera, and these poor people would come off the plane and think, oh my goodness, where are we? And we would say, come off the plane and think, oh my God, we're in heaven. And we would eat lunch on the beach every day because we were on the Riviera. And my mother would make these sandwiches. She would take the tuna, she would take anchovies, she would take whatever she could find, you know, salty, tasty, juicy things, cucumbers, tomatoes, capers, olive oil, because there was so much olive oil there. She'd put together the sandwich, and when she was done, it was like one of those Dagwood sandwiches. You know, those sandwiches that are so thick and big, you couldn't even put your mouth around it. It was so big. So the trick was she'd have to flatten the sandwich out, right? So what she would do is she'd wrap it up in foil and have me and my sister sit on it, basically, until it flattened out. So we would be sitting there, you know, dying to go to the beach. And my mother would say, no, we can't go to the beach yet. We have to flatten the sandwich. So I would take a turn and I would sit on it. And my sister would take a turn and she would sit on it. We would sit with that thing, you know, underneath us as a cushion all the way on the drive to the beach in the car. And when we got there, what was so great about it was that the capers had burst, the anchovies had almost smushed into a paste, and the olive oil and tuna had just anointed the bread, and the whole thing was flat enough to take a bite of, and it was so good. By the time we got there, we couldn't even wait till lunchtime. We ripped that thing open probably at about 11 o'clock. And just sitting there on the beach eating this pan bagnat is one of my favorite memories from being a kid, but I make it at home all the time, and I don't have a 7-year-old. I was 7 at the time. I remember I was 7, 8, and 9. And I only have a 2-year-old, and she is not big enough to sit on my pan bagnat. So I use a big, heavy cookbook, and I take a couple of cans just from the cupboard and put them right on top and let it sit for a couple of hours. It is so good.
You know, that is such a good idea because I'm just thinking what happens to, you know, anything with mayonnaise. Things just get sopping wet on a picnic.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I think that's my philosophy for picnic food in general. You know, it's not just with sandwiches. I mean, when you take any kind of marinated vegetable or marinated meat or fish or something that you're seasoning with olive oil and vinegar and you're making a vinaigrette, instead of a traditional picnic fare, you know, we think, oh, potato salad, mm-hmm. which has mayonnaise mm-hmm. in it. If you think of something with olive oil and lemon juice or vinegar instead, what you're doing is you're marinating your ingredients and while you're, you know, playing soccer or going to the beach or doing whatever you do before your picnic lunch, it's just going to get better. For example, have you ever bought those wonderful marinated artichokes and olives that you can...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Tossing those together with boiled potatoes and maybe pieces of cheese like mozzarella or Gruyere or even pieces of leftover steak or leftover chicken, a little bit of olive oil and vinegar on top, some fresh chopped herbs. Mm. You can put that together in a big plastic container. Just give it a big shake. And then the great thing about it is because everything's already cut up into chunks, all you need to do is take your fork and you can eat it right out of the container. You don't need a knife. You don't need, you know, it's not messy. It's pretty clean. A couple of napkins and a couple of forks and you're all set, which is really great for a picnic because you don't want to have a lot of trash. You know, you don't want to have to carry that stuff out with you. You want it to be pretty compact.
But you do need the 7-year-olds for the sandwich.
Yeah. I can't wait for Dahlia to grow up and get a little bit older because I'm going to have her bouncing on that sandwich as soon as she weighs more than, you know, 20 pounds.
Melissa, thanks.
Thank you, Lynn. Going on a big
with me, with you. Melissa Clark's written In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite. Well, we've got her pan bagna recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Lamentably, we can't supply the 7-year-olds to finish the sandwich. Jason Pfeiffer cannot smell, so he can't experience flavor. Yet he writes about eating, the pleasures of eating. Can a man who can't taste tell us how to eat? He sat down to talk with our Sally Swift.
Imagine a flavorless world, and I mean flavorless. No tang of sharp cheddar, no bitter edge to salad greens, no sweetness in ice cream. Unimaginable, right?
Okay, so I'm Jason Pfeiffer, and I don't taste things the way you do. I didn't actually know that I had a problem until college when I was dating a girl who had a really great sense of smell and was the first person to push me because she was trying to figure out the nuances of these things that she was eating and smelling. And that's when I realized for the first time, I'm not coming anywhere near understanding the things that she's experiencing. I have hyposmia, which means diminished sense of smell. People have anosmia, which is a completely absent sense of smell. I have hyposmia. To be honest, I don't know how it's best pronounced, which is a diminished sense of smell. And mine is severely, severely diminished. My olfactory nerves are broken or fried or blocked. My tongue works just fine. And that tells me if something is sweet, salty, sour, or bitter. But it's in fact your sense of smell, it's your olfactory nerves that tell you the flavor of something. And that's what turns sweet into chocolate. That's what mm-hmm. turns salty into a potato chip. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that. So I'm pretty much limited to food in 4 basic categories.
So is food pleasurable for you?
Yes, but no. It's like a boring pleasure. It's a repetitive pleasure. Every candy is the same. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what it is. It's butterscotch or it's chocolate or it's, you know, it's funny. I try to come up with like foods to reference and I always just would blank out because I just like my mind doesn't even think about food in a reverential enough way. But anyway, that's all the same. It's all the same.
And so texture must be a huge...
So texture's big to me. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like going out to eat. I think mm-hmm. that you can taste atmosphere as much as you can taste the actual food being served. And so I like going to new restaurants and seeing the way that dishes are presented. I mean, you know, a lot of the way that our brain processes food is not actually based on just the tastes and the flavors, but is also how it looks and how it feels and how it sounds.
And how it's described. I'm sure it must be huge for you to go in a restaurant and have someone describe what the dish is, right?
Yeah. I actually like reading through menus and seeing what's in the dish, even though every ingredient there is going to taste exactly the same to me. I mean, if I didn't know it was there while I was eating it, I wouldn't know it at all. But, you know, intriguingly, that's not all that different from the way that normal people eat. We do a lot of filling in our minds. There was this great experiment that a researcher named Rachel Herz did. She told me about it, where she had people smell this chemical compound that was in a jar, and she told them that it was cheese. And they smelled it, and they were like, it's nice. And she's like, what would you do with it? Well, we would eat it. And then a week later, she had the same people come in, and she gave them the same jar with the same chemicals. And she's like, this is vomit. And they were like, ooh, awful, you know. And what that goes to show you is that our understanding of what it is that we're eating really impacts the actual experience mm-hmm. of eating it.
Isn't that crazy? It's pretty hard to comprehend. It really makes you think. I wanted to really get down to the nuts and bolts of what his experience really is when he eats something, so I asked if he'd consider a taste test. I thought I needed to bring it down to the basics, you know, have him taste something really distinctive, like Cheetos.
Okay, we've got two here, the classic and the Flaming Hot, which we've never had.
Flaming Hot.
Flaming Hot.
They've dropped
not
the
only
G.
Flaming.
That's how hot it is.
Let's see how
Flaming Hot they are. You know, I think I've gotten really used to heat. Well, here, I mean, let's just see if I can. All right. Yeah, there's nothing flaming about this.
What do you taste, though? Do you taste cheese? Do you taste...
No. I taste a little bit of heat, which I like.
Taste like cardboard? What are you...
Yeah.
Describe what you are tasting.
Sure. All right, let me... I'm going to consume two bags of Cheetos during this because the sensation of whatever it is that I'm getting goes away. Man, it goes away so fast. It's like trying to grab sand that's falling in front of you. There's a little bit of salt to it. I get that. I like the crunchiness. Actually, can you tell me, is this cheesy? Like, is
yes,
this?
Those yeah, they're really cheesy.
Yeah, like cheesy, like actual cheese?
Like cheddar could, cheesy, really? like really amped up cheddar cheese is what the goal is.
Well, I mean, I guess they've accomplished it for somebody, but not for me.
Has there been a moment that you have really, has there been a particularly poignant moment for you when you've really wished that you had had full sense of smell?
Yeah. Absolutely. When I travel, mostly. Because when people talk about traveling, they always talk about the food. And I definitely feel like I'm missing something there. One other time, I guess, is when I met Jen, who is now my fiance. She is really into food and was really disappointed to learn that I wasn't able to enjoy food with her the way that she enjoys food. And I mean, for one, I'm so boring to go to a restaurant with. and I always order the same things. I'm not that curious. I find something that I like, but also I can't cook because I can't course correct. I can't taste something and know if I've made it right. I set the fire alarm off every time because I can't smell when something's burning. So we have a system in our kitchen, and that is that she does all the actual combining of ingredients, and I will do as much chopping and running to the store and doing the garbage runs and dishwashing as she wants.
Sounds to me like you've met your match.
Yeah, I have.
Lovely talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Jason Pfeiffer's story, A Matter of Taste, was in the May 2011 issue of Men's Health. Now, in a tribute to Jason's love of texture, we've got a recipe. Hoisin China noodles with four flavors, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org.
Talk to me. Talk to me.
The lines are open. We're going to take your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. You can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Pat's calling from Brandon, Mississippi. So, Pat, hi. What's up?
Hi, Lynn. I got a great gift from my brother, and he sent me, normally he sends me venison that, you know, he's hunted.
Right.
But this year he sent me some red stag that was farm grown. And I've got a couple of sirloin tip roasts.
Ooh.
And it's a little richer than beef, and a little milder than a wild venison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the venison, what I used to do was I would marinate just for a little while because I never want to overpower the meat.
Right.
I would marinate it in sweet vermouth.
Right.
And, some Worcestershire. And then what I would do is when it was all done, I'd make a gravy out of that with sautéed onions and mushrooms in it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that was a big hit, but I'm not sure that that would do well with the red stag.
Well, if you're saying it's really rich, I think what I would love to see happen to it is that you contrast it. So why not do something like a generous amount of garlic, puree that with red wine, olive oil, and then, I'm in my citrus zest period here.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it's showing up in everything. But citrus zest, something that enlivens it.
Uh-huh.
And I would, don't do a long marinade, because marinades really don't do a lot.
Right.
You know, and you know the trick. You want to cook it fairly slowly. Because,
okay.
Yeah, because is the meat rather lean or does it tend to be well marbled?
It's very lean.
Then you really want to cook it low and slow.
Okay.
Because that's going to help keep it really juicy.
Okay.
And then you'll slice it across the grain.
Yeah, right.
But I would do garlic, red wine, a bit of citrus zest, and olive oil. And I would, you know, you could even skip the marinade. You could just baste that over it as it cooks.
Okay.
Be really delicious.
I'll try it.
All right, Pat.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
This week's trivia challenge is here. Now, the question is, what new candy was under armed guard at the 2011 Sweets and Snacks Expo? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be back in touch with you in a moment. You can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what new candy was under armed guard at the 2011 Sweets and Snacks Expo? It was jelly beans, gold jelly beans. They were wrapped in 24-karat gold leaf. This was a big deal, but the other big deal was that they tasted of rare spices and herbs, the gimmick being that we're supposed to take three or four of these on our tongues to create a never-before-experienced-in-history taste event. Oh, and I almost forgot. They come in a crystal jar. And did I mention that the jelly beans will sell for $500 a pound? Now that is a never-before-experienced event. Okay. Back to your calls. The lines are open. We've got Kelly on the line from Seattle. So, Kelly, what's up?
Hello, Lynn. I'm calling for a little premarital counseling.
I beg your pardon.
We want everything to start off very well. I've met a wonderful, wonderful man who is an amazing cook just for me. And it comes down to ribs, Lynn. Yes.
In what way exactly?
He boils his ribs. I don't want to annoy my future in-laws by getting down on this, but personally, I find this kind of disgusting. It just makes them, in my opinion, chewy or like kind of mealy when he does it, and my personal opinion, and I told him I'd have to consult with you on all of this, is you marinate them, you put them in the oven on low heat, that, or you just barbecue them.
Now, does he grill them or whatever after they've been boiled?
Not always. Living in Seattle, we don't always have the luxury of getting outside, though I'm sure he would be out there in 20 degrees if he could.
Okay, you have really put me in a very difficult position, Kelly.
Uh-oh.
All right. No. Well, I feel like I'm getting in the middle here, but it's good you're going to settle this before you walk down the aisle. And
exactly.
And you might want to add an addendum to your vows to cover this issue. Or if you have a prenup, add it to the prenup.
Okay.
I don't want to discourage your fiancé from cooking, but boiling the ribs ahead of time is an old technique. Mm-hmm. And it really shouldn't be boiling. It should be barely, the liquid barely bubbles. And because if you boil it, it gets very tough and dry. It's so interesting that you can cook meat in liquid and it can end up being dry. And it's because it gets too hot. And even with a stew. OK, but basically, you don't really need to do that because what you can do is exactly what you do. And marinate or don't marinate, but you want to have it cook long, slow, and low. So the idea is that low oven or the grill is really low and you want to cook it gradually because this is chewy meat and you're going to just keep breaking down that structure of the meat with the slow cooking and it'll get crispy and lovely and gorgeous. So now I am backing away because I do not want to be responsible for you two having any difficulties.
Oh, that's brilliant, Lynn. I think his spaghetti sauce more than makes up for it.
It sounds like he's a gem. A little misdirected,
absolutely.
But he's a gem.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Well, congratulations to both of you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Call us 800-537-5252 or send an email, splendidtable.org. We've got Jesse on the line from St. Louis. So, Jesse, what is up? What is on your mind?
Okay. I've recently begun to experiment kind of around the kitchen. I'm very, very new at this. And I was just wondering what you would think would be maybe the top 5 or 10 herbs or spices to keep in the pantry.
You know, this is a great question no matter where you are in cooking. You know, what are the essentials is what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. I think it depends on what tastes you like, number one. So if I mention something that you say, oh, I really don't like the taste of that, then for goodness sakes, don't use it.
Okay.
Okay. But I think that ideally, if you can, to have fresh herbs is the best idea. Okay.
Right.
And they can be bought and frozen. And with the season warming up, farmers markets are going to start having bundles of herbs, and usually they're ridiculously inexpensive, and they freeze brilliantly.
Great.
Okay? So that's not a problem. So I mean, basil, number one,
okay.
Thyme, sage, rosemary. I would say probably fresh coriander, but that's something you have to like. Number one. And number two, that generally doesn't really freeze well. You want to use it, you know, by the bunch and when it's fresh. In the spice world, you'd want whole peppercorns for a pepper mill. You'd want to have whatever spices you like. For instance, in my refrigerator is a collection of chilies. You know, dry chilies, either ground or not, because I'm crazy for chilies.
Right.
So, no, but, you know, if that's true for you...
Yeah, I love them.
Yeah, then you may want to start gradually as you run across things, trying different chilies. I keep them in the fridge because they tend to have volatile oils and they just tend to stay fresher longer.
Okay.
So chilies, if you love them in the spice world. If you really like cinnamon, I'm cooking with a lot of allspice lately. I'm putting it with tomatoes. I'm putting it in soups. I'm putting it with carrots and root vegetables. And, you know, it's just one of those things. So you may want to keep some allspice. And one of the tricks is interesting. You may want to buy two pepper mills. One is for pepper and another one is for grinding your own spices or just have an extra coffee grinder. And you can buy cinnamon sticks and whole allspice. And by the way, those keep a very long time, like a year. And then you grind them up as you need them. You can do that with, you know, whole coriander or cumin or whatever. You see?
I know probably not everybody's going to have time to grind their own. So if you're just going to buy the pre-ground spices, all right, here's what I think you need. Cumin, coriander, clove, ginger, okay, allspice, cinnamon, and then, as I said, anything in the chili family. And then you take off from there. So that's you, there are some basics for you.
Yes, that sounds great. And then with the chilies, with the dried ones, I've seen them in the grocery store, and I'm a little intimidated because I don't know how to cut them up.
Do you mean the dried ones, the whole dried ones? Okay,
yes.
This is generally the process with them. Generally, the first thing you do is you lightly toast them.
Okay.
Now, this depends what culture you're in. Especially with Mexican food, you always toast them.
Okay.
But the idea is that you generally lightly toast them so that they just start to smell good. You don't want to burn them.
Okay.
This takes minutes, you know, a minute maybe.
Right.
Then you break off the stem. You generally get rid of the seeds because that's where a lot of the heat is. Not that it's still going to be hot, but some people like to keep the seeds. Some people don't. It's a matter of choice. And then you soak them in warm water until they get really soft.
Great.
And then you can drain off that water and puree them or use them however you want. Other cultures, that's Mexico, other cultures do it where they just crush the chilies and that's
okay.
it. Now, one of the things I've done is I take really hot dried chilies and I put them in vinegar with some sugar and fish sauce.
Mm.
And that sits up. I mean, it's hot as the devil, but the sugar kind of cuts it a bit and the fish sauce gives it saltiness. And it's really
right.
I just sprinkle that on things, or I throw it in a salad dressing, or I, you know, as I'm cooking something, I'll add just a little bit of that. You don't really know
right.
it's there kind of thing.
That
so,
sounds great. I might try that tonight.
Yeah. You know, easy. And it just sticks around on the counter. It'll last forever.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much.
You are launched.
I will try all of these. Okay. Thank
hey,
you.
Hey, call
Lynn.
Us again with any questions.
I will. Thank
okay,
you.
Bye. You can reach us 800-537-5252. We've got Amy on the line from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Amy, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, I have a question about cooking utensils. It seems like every time I get a bunch of wooden or bamboo spoons and such, there's always an odd kind of paddle-shaped spoon that has a hole in it in the middle of it, about the size of a nickel. And I'm wondering, what in the world is that for?
It's a stirrer.
There's no special use for it?
Well, you know, I have them too. and I use them to stir things. But I mean, a batter of something or whatever. But frankly, I find that to be one of the most useless pieces of equipment around.
Okay, good. So I'm not crazy.
You're not crazy at all.
Right.
No, it's somebody's idea of, you know, consider it. It's an unimaginative whisk, where a whisk is all these wires with all the air between them, so that when you stir with it, a lot of breaking up happens. This is the poor man's whisk. There's just one single gap. It doesn't do very much. Now, I know we're going to get a flood of emails and calls of people saying, I can't live without it. But basically, you don't need this.
Okay. Yeah, because I generally just use it as a wooden spoon. And I thought,
yeah,
I wonder if there's some special technique that
I'm looking
for.
No. I always figure I use a wooden spatula all the time. That's my one thing I can't live without. And because it sweeps everything up, but you don't need that.
Okay.
You can start your fireplace with it or something if you want, or give it away to somebody else.
All right. Or
okay.
I'll just keep stirring. So.
Here you go.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. You can follow us on Twitter. Shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Well, the dinner party guys are joining us from L.A., Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan. Hey, you guys, how are you doing?
Hello, Lynn.
Hey, Lynn, happy to be here.
You know, I'm thinking about the fact that every week you come up with conversation ideas that are based on what's happening in the news. But do you have any evergreen topics, you know, the things that are guaranteed to get that stalled dinner party going?
Yeah, I think we have a couple approaches. One that I find works is contrarianism.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, which I think is underrated in America.
You mean the idea of challenge?
Yeah, the idea of challenging a popular opinion, and not just for the sake of challenging a popular opinion, but you should believe what you're saying. But this comes up in our show a lot with, for the most famous example is cupcakes. I don't like cupcakes.
He really doesn't like cupcakes.
Yeah, and I've made that clear on my show, and people love talking to me about it. They send us mail, they send us links to cupcakes, they make fun of me about it. But it's a really fun way to have a discussion, and no one's really getting hurt because the stakes are low. We're just talking about cupcakes.
That's right. He wants to sort of start a similar war over brunch, but we haven't quite figured that one out yet.
Well, these are the issues that stir men's souls.
That's right.
Obviously.
Cupcakes are
obviously
are infuriating.
Are there any other? I mean, like, for instance, one of my favorites is first dates.
Oh, in terms of topics of conversation, actually, first dates is probably pretty good. I think what you're talking about is the idea that kind of extremes, and I don't mean that in like extreme sports, but sort of asking about moments that really stand out in someone's mind tend to bring up really great conversation moments. A first date would be great. Worst experience traveling, something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of challenging people to bring out those stories, I think, can keep a dinner party going for many, many hours.
Okay, so this helps us. Because, you know, I think the worst thing that happens is when the table falls silent and nobody knows what to talk about.
Yes, it's extremely uncomfortable as a host when that happens. But sometimes you also have to let that happen. And I think your guests will take their cues from you at the top of the table.
That's
and
true.
You can even just acknowledge it and kind of have a meta moment.
It's true. I will say that when you were talking about that, I kind of wanted to just like be silent for like just an uncomfortable several seconds to let the audience know what that feels like. But in radio, that's not good.
Yeah, but you've got a very good point. Somebody always feels like they've got to fill in.
That's right.
It is true.
But let's talk food. You know, I think of L.A. as being sort of trend central. So, Brendan Francis, what are you seeing? What is really new now?
Well, one of the things we're seeing, food trucks are everywhere. They've taken over.
And not just in L.A.
In L.A., there's been a big food truck explosion. But the thing that we're seeing right now is the arrival of the sushi Rito.
You heard right.
That's right. This is a sushi burrito hybrid. And you can find one in L.A. There's a guy named, he has a truck called Yogasaki. And this is basically, there's a couple of variations, but his is spicy tuna, crab meat, avocado, cucumber, and shrimp tempura inside soy paper.
That's right.
So it kind of acts kind of like a tortilla, and it's folded like a burrito. You can get a tortilla. I had the soy paper when I had it.
Yeah.
But it looks like a burrito, and it eats like a burrito. It's just this monster that you plow your way through, and it's only $6.
Oh, my God. It sounds fabulous. It really does.
It is. It was surprisingly good. Brendan actually interviewed this guy, and he brought some back to the office, and people were kind of gawking at it for a while. I actually dared to take a bite, and I actually really liked it.
It was delicious.
Is this sort of the California roll gone berserk?
This is a California roll on steroids. And of course, this sushi Rito is a collision of cultures that we see in L.A., the home of, you know, the Korean taco. This is, you know, Japan and Mexico, Japexican cuisine, as we say.
At last.
So Rico, anything else that's a real standout, a new find?
There is, and this is actually coming from the other trend central in California, especially in the food world, obviously, which would be San Francisco. There's a thing called the underground market. Have you heard of this?
No.
It is, it's really fascinating. It is basically a food rave, if you know what I'm talking about. You know, raves, kind of these musical dance parties
right.
that used to be held. Well, this is kind of like the food version of that. It happens monthly. You pay $8 to get into what's basically a night market, except it happens in a club. And there's kind of a complex rationale for how vendors get into this club to sell you food. It's limited to vendors who don't have access to commercial kitchens. So these are people like home cooks.
They're underground cooks.
Basically. They don't have the money or the wherewithal to get, you know, a commercial kitchen. And this is a means for them to sort of start making money so they can earn enough money to afford a commercial kitchen and start a real business.
So it's a bunch of food stalls, people selling like chutneys or something they make at home, as well as gnocchi. Like they'll make food on site. So there's prepared foods and jarred foods that
it's
people
really
are making
something.
At home that aren't professional foodies.
And we're talking thousands of people show up to this thing.
Wow.
Yeah, it started with about 150 people. I went up to San Francisco a couple of weeks ago for this, and there were, I think they expected 3,000 people to go through their doors.
Guys, this is really interesting. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having us, Lynn.
Thank you, Lynn.
Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan are the minds behind APM's dinner party. Well, thanks for joining us. That's the show for this week. We're going to be back next week, so stay in touch. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Colette, who said, "Rudeness is the weak man's imitation of strength."
Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Check out our new series of podcasts, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. And take a look at our newest project, a summertime grilling guide, 40 recipes to get you cooking outside this summer. All the information is, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Peters. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.